Okay. Good morning. We are going to go into testing today. I don't think we're going to be able to go through everything today, so some of it's going to be tomorrow as well. My plan is that we're going to go through testing in general first, and then talk about database application testing. So you've had, I think Tom talked about testing in the software engineering course, and in Frode's course you had to do a manual test procedure and go through manual testing. So this is the first time, I guess, most of you have seen the test automation, how we have make the programs that actually do the tests. We don't have to do it manually. Tom has talked about it, but I don't think you've seen it before. That has nothing to do with databases, but there are some specific issues for database testing, and that's really the core piece of knowledge that we need to take from this course. But since we haven't done it before, we also need to spend a little bit of time to bring you up to speed on what test automation is. So my plan is for today to talk about it, tomorrow a little bit as well, and then tomorrow my plan is that we'll take the assignment application, and I'm going to go through a case for you where we say, okay, now let's say we add some functionality. So what we're going to do is, you remember the assignment application? What we want to do is to add the possibility of sorting the list on the various fields here. So in this case, it's sorted by the ID. I could sort it by title. Now, unfortunately, my test case are bad because the order of titles is the same as the order of the ID, so nothing happens. But if I go here to author, it changes the order. And I go back, and I want the app to be such that I can't click it twice. I don't have to sort both ways. So I can just sort ascending order, and I click one. So what we'll do tomorrow is, from here, we're going to go through what is the work process. Now we obviously need to change the data model. We need to change probably the controller, probably and we need the unit tests, and we need the acceptance tests. So I will go through all of it. So we see it all playing together, and hopefully that gives you a better understanding of why we're doing this and what's the benefit. But that's for tomorrow. Today, we are here. And on Friday, we'll try to wrap up this first block and do one little thing that we haven't talked about, which is how do we program for transactions, what the transaction is and how we program for it. So that's going to be on Friday. And then you're finally going to start the database course. What we are doing here is just to give you an understanding of why we are doing this course, what's it going to end up doing. And then we're going to do, how do we query, how do we model, how do we access data that's hierarchical, how do we optimize the database system and administer and deal with security. So that's kind of, so this is really the start of the course next week. What we're doing so far is just understanding what it's going to mean to us. So I hope it's not feeling too bad spending 3 weeks never getting to start on the course. But I think it gives you a lot of understanding. And when we're doing all of this, you can apply it immediately because you've already gone through this first part. Are you getting through the fog, or are you still in the middle of the fog when it comes to the assignments? It's a foggy environment. Lots of things that you still don't really understand what's happening. Yeah. So because of this, if you see that you won't be able to complete the assignment by Sunday, I had a meeting with the reference group here at the beginning of the week, and we found that it's a good option to extend a little bit. So if you can't complete it, you see now already that you can't complete it by Sunday, send me an email. No later than on Friday. I like to know in advance who needs an extension. And then it's not going to be a very long one, because on Wednesday, Dipti is going to start on the database, and I'm not going to steal time from her. So what I'm going to give you then is extension till Wednesday, midnight, so between Wednesday and Thursday. So 3 more days to work. If you are reasonably close to complete already, I suggest not extending. Just do it, get over with it, and have a couple of days break before we move into the next topic. But if you see you really need it, I think it's much better to actually do the assignment. And the teaching assistants are going to be in the lab on Monday, so they can help you. For those who don't have a Monday, look up the course in the time planning system and to see if you have time or if it doesn't conflict with your other lectures, so you can show up on Monday and talk to TAs if you need, or come to my office and get help from me. Because I think it's, even though what we're doing is, it's more on the hands-on, how are you going to use databases in the program, I think it's very, very useful, and it's an important part of the course to go through this. So if you see that you need extra time, just send me it. I have to apologize a little bit because I'm lagging a bit behind. I got an email about some errors, and I'll talk about them a little bit in the tests. I'll talk about them a little bit when it comes to the unit tests. And some of you have sent me emails that I haven't been able to answer. I think I will have time after the lecture today, so I think I should be able to catch up with all of this by the end of the day at least. Any questions, any general concerns, issues? You could talk to me anytime directly or talk to the reference group. I hope you know who is the reference group from your class. Just discuss it, talk to me, to the TAs, whatever, because we are here to try to get through the fog, not to try to make the fog denser. Okay, so what we'll do today? We'll start by talking about automated testing, and I apologize if I'm overlapping too much with what Thomas said already, but I think it's testing is important, so I think it's a good idea to revisit the topic, talking about various types of tests. I don't know if Tom talked about behavior-driven development. I'll just mention it very briefly, what it is. It's something coming up and something that is quite interesting. And then we'll go into the two unit testing and acceptance testing, which is kind of what we do. In this part, I'm not going to talk specifically about databases. You will see some examples that involve some database, but in general, this is application testing in any program, any case. So, testing. We have manual testing, and we have automated testing. And I hope you already did spend some time in through this course to write down, think about what the test should be like. What are the criteria for a successful, and what are the exceptional cases that should be dealt with and should give a correct handling or a correct response? So, as I said, we're going to be talking about automated testing, where we leave it to the test program to do the testing, and we'll come back to why this is a good idea. When we talk about testing, there are a lot of things that can be tested. Of course, functionality. We want the system to behave as specified. We want the system to give the user the response they expect and work nicely. Security. We already seen that I have this test for SQL injection to make sure that the user can type in accidentally or by purpose something that would break the system and get the users to have access to data he shouldn't have access to. These are the two we're going to talk about now. There are lots of more about testing that I won't be mentioning, and hopefully you had a little bit about it and you will see more. One is performance. Of course, you will like your database system to be responsive. So if you transfer money, you don't want to wait for an hour to see the money being transferred from one account to the other. So you would like to have performance. Usability. There is a lot to say about usability and some of the tools that we're using daily. I mean, not to mention Blackboard, just came to my mind. And there are other programs in which it's very hard to understand really what the designers were thinking, because it doesn't match what we were thinking. So usability testing And there's a course on ergonomics and on how you involve users into the process that is very much about usability. Portability, the fact that especially on web, the problem with the web technologies is that users have their browsers. The browser is kind of the environment for the applications. And you have, of course, browsers on different platforms. And then you have generations of browsers. I mean, some are still running early versions of Windows Explorer and expect to be able to get to the bank. So there are lots of issues in terms of what versions of browsers work for the various applications. We're going to ignore all this. We'll focus on functionality and say a little bit about security. Just to show the manual versus the automatic testing, because I think it's easiest for us to understand how to write a good test for test automation by thinking about what we would do if we were to test this as a human being. If we were a tester, then what would we do to verify? And what we do is that, first of all, we get ready. We bring the system up in initial state. So let's say we want to test this application. What do I do? Well, I get to the starting page. This is where I want to be. And what do I expect to see? Well, first of all, I expect to see this page, nothing else. I expect to see this title. I expect to see the three books that I know is in my database. I expect to see that I can enter data and add a new book. So this is what I, as a human being, expect to see. And if I click on this book, I expect to see details about it. If you go back to so we bring the system of the initial state, meaning we go to the home page, we do something, which is we click on the link to the book number 2, and the result is we get the detail page. And then, as a human being, we will review that result. 3 steps, we set it up, we call the function, and we get the result, and now we test to see is the result what we expect it to be. That's the simple process. What do we do in the automatic or the automated process? The same thing. Number one, we set it up. If you started, who has not yet started on the acceptance testing? Okay, if you look at that test, you see there's a call, I'm on page. I am on page. That's the start of all the acceptance tests, which is really saying, okay, this is my initial state. I am on a certain page. And then, what do I do on that page? I typically invoke something. I click on that too. So that's what the program test program is going to do. It's going to act as a user. So when I, as a user, clicked on that link, in this case, I want my test program to click on the link. And then I go to the review stage in which I'm trying to test. And these are called asserts. Assert means that this is what I expect to see. And I put an assertion, which means that the system or the test system is going to then try to see, is this the case? If the assertion is true, everything is fine. If the assertion fails, it means that there's something wrong, either with the test or with the response. So if we just if you go to this show book details test, setting up, I am on this page. I do expect to see the link to book number 1. That's linking here. I go and click it, and I do want these details to be details. So this is a function I have just for testing the book details to see that it has the right title, it has the right author, it has the right ID and everything. So this is what the testing is about. We initialize the object to some state that we know we know exactly what the state is. And then we call the operation, and we know what the result state should be. So what we need to do now is to just test. to test that the state is as is. What is the state here? If you look at the book details, the state here could be many things. Number one, that the title of this page is book details. Number two, that I have an ID here. Number three is that I have all of these, that I have these buttons, that I have these fields to change, I have this button, I have these links. That's the state. These are the elements I expect to see. So that's kind of the state, if you want, of this web page. And if I go back, the state here is that it's the book collection page, and it has a list of title, a list of books, and I expect them to be three, and these three exactly. That's what I expect. And this is what I see. So now I can see the test has passed because my expectations are met, or the assertions are true, if you want to use this term here. So in the first part of the assignment, I gave you the tests. So I specified what is the state to test for. But when you write a test, you have to decide what will be the test cases, what will be the data you would like to test against. And here, we find that we can't possibly test all combinations. Usually there are far too many combinations that we can test all of them, which means that we need to pick a few that are that we can call representative, because we have to assume that in the code there is something like if something is less than or bigger than, we do a chunk of code. So if we are between two boundaries, we do something. Then we can assume that whatever value within that range, the program will behave the same way. So, or going back here, if I want to test that book details is correct, do I need to test for all of them, or is it okay to test for one? And we assume that the code is pretty much the same, so it doesn't matter if I do one, two, or three, it should behave the same way. So we don't have to write one test for each one of them, possibly. Now, if we see that one is different, one has something blank here, and if we are worried that blank can cause a problem, then we may need to test one that is with description and one that is without description. You follow me? So we have to try to find certain typical values, and we choose one of them. Not every combination, because then our test programs are going to be too... sometimes we can't write them, and sometimes they're just going to be so large that it's going to take so long time to create them and the test and run them that no one would run them. So that's why we pick representative values. And depending on the type of values you can run the tests on, we can talk about equivalence partitioning. What does equivalent partitioning mean? Well, it means that we divide the possible values into partitions. In my case, let's say we would like to test these two cases. One is with description and one is without description. Other than that, we have to assume that they are just the same. Then our partition is one, the books with description, and two, books without description. And then we just test the two cases to see that they are handled nicely everywhere. You follow me on that? So, we try to find what these ranges are, what type of values that will be representative. And we find different groups, and we choose one within each group for the testing. So, this is a long text to read. Basic idea, let's go through this and think together. Let's say that you are to write a function that is supposed to give the user how much he earned, what his daily salary is, depending on how many hours he worked. And the salary scheme is like if he works up to 8 hours, he gets the hourly rate multiplied by the number of hours. If he works overtime for the first 4 hours, he gets 150% of his salary, and for the next 4 hours, he gets 200%. if he works more than 16 hours, he is not allowed to do so, so he can't get more paid. So the max is 16 hours. So you have from 0 to 8, you have from 8 to 12, you have from 12 to 16, and you have 16 to 24. Kind of ranges here. Which means that what are the... Oops. I was going to here. If you go here. So what are the equivalence partitions? Let's see, we need to draw... So here, so this is from 0, and obviously in one day we can't do more than 24. So how do we partition it, this? And then we can, let's see, we can do this. Because, I mean, we typically have, these are real numbers, so we typically have ranges of, I mean, if you enter something, it could be 250. It should be between 0 and 24. Any ideas? How do we want to partition this? If you wanted to run some testing to see that finding the correct payment works. Equally by 4 hours? Okay. So we could do that. This is 0. Oops, sorry. I'm just going to do... Go back to my style. So this is 4, 8, 12. Okay, so this wasn't too good. 12, 16, 20, and then let's move 24 over here then. Just for the fun of it. Okay, something like this. You all agree? We don't necessarily need to have continuous or equally sized partitions. Question?
From 0 to 8 and from 8 to 12,
yeah, that's an alternative. So we can say, okay, between 0 and 8, there's nothing, there's same. I mean, 4 hours, 6 hours is going to be the rate. So we can put in just a number here. So 8. 12, do we need 12? Yes, because that's the next kind of... and then 16. Do we need 20? No, again, because 20 is the same as 17 or 23. So we delete that. Give us a, this. So this is handwritten, a little bit on the edge. But anyway, this would then be the partitions. So we could choose anyone between 0 and 8, anyone between 8 and 12, anyone between 12 and 16, and then for 16 to 24, or actually for 16 to whatever, we could just say, this is too much. Anything less than 0, we will say, this is too little. You don't have to pay us if you've worked less than 0 hours. So the big question here is, would it be enough to test in this range, in this range, in this range, and the outside ranges, or maybe need to worry about something more? So what he was saying is that we need maybe in some cases as well test the borders, the exact borders. So 8 hours, because 8 is between getting 100% and 150%. So what if you're working 8 hours, are we sure that we don't mess up in that on the border? So sometimes We have to worry about testing exactly 8 hours, exactly 12 hours, exactly 16 hours. Because these are boundary cases. And some cases, boundaries don't matter. Some cases, they do. So what we typically end up doing is that we end up a test for each of the boundary cases and one in the middle. We don't have to test for 7 hours, 7.5 hours, 6.5 hours, 6 hours. We just pick one and assume that in the range, they are all handled the same way. Because in the code, we have to assume that there is a test on 8. But as I was saying up there, the question is, do they use less than or less than or equal? That may matter. So we may need to test the boundary cases as well. Oops, that wasn't what I was... there we go. Again, the partition doesn't have to be the same size. It could be. It doesn't have to be uniform. So we can have small partitions where there is something happening frequently, and we can have large partitions where things don't happen that quickly. So, testing. There are many levels of testing. At the top, we have the unit testing, which is the smallest possible component we can test. We test one small unit, see that it does its job. But units work together in modules. So let's say we would like to test the whole database module, or the whole controller module, or the view module. Then we talk about whole modules. And then modules may be grouped into subsystems. Subsystems work together as a system. And in the end, we have acceptance tests. In our case, we do the unit testing, and we do acceptance testing. Codeception has one more, if you remember, one more, which is the functional testing, which is really when they have frameworks in here. So if you use kind of Laravel or some PHP framework, then you have here something at the subsystem level where you have interaction with the frameworks. But we're going to focus on the very smallest and the very largest. This one is closest to the programmer. This one is closest to the end user. Did you see this diagram before? I think Tom probably did show it. This is from somewhere else's book, so it's quite... And this is then probably quite familiar. What are the characteristics of a unit test? First of all, they are really, really easy to write because you have so little code. You have a typically a class, and then you write tests for the operations on the class. And it's typically easy to find the cause of failure. When something fails, you know that we call this function, and the function is doing very little because it's just within the class. Cheap to run, because they don't involve a lot of things. They just involve the class, and you call a method, and you look at the results. Encourages loose coupling. What do I mean by that? You know what loose coupling is? It means that you write the classes so that they are tightly coupled within the class, but there are as few interactions between the classes as possible. So you group together what belongs together, so you don't have two classes that constantly talk to each other. Then you probably will like to merge them together and have one class that does everything. So loose coupling is better because if you find a problem, we know it's in this class. It's not because it's spread over many classes. And if you want to make it make unit testing easy, we like to make all code that you test to be within one class. Okay, so a good design for testing is also a good design for design, because it encourages loose coupling. So we would like to group together what belongs together that can be tested together independently of most of the other stuff. It's usually written by the developers, because to write unit tests, this is called white box testing, meaning that we need to know what the function looked like. We need to know the function signatures and what the response is for each of the functions in the class. So this is typically not something that the end user worries about. The end user worries about can I sort, not whether the one function inside the data model is not working properly. Which is also the problem, because the developer had been thinking about what the code should do, and that was what it tests. You would often want somebody else to write your test because they think of this differently and they may see something that you haven't thought about. So it is it's not the best in terms of writing tests that that will really be detecting problems that you have forgotten about in your design. Because if you've forgotten about the design, you probably have forgotten about the test for it as well. Because of this, it's a good idea to write the tests early, possibly before you write any code. I will come back to that. Acceptance tests. Why do we then have acceptance tests? I mean, if you have a program with many classes, many objects, or many modules, why do we need to run an acceptance test if you tested all the classes? So the fact that they work as specified by themselves doesn't mean that they work together as they are supposed to. So we'll have a look at that tomorrow when we go through the test case. I'll demo tomorrow. But yeah, and what it says is that it creates confidence in the application, because when we run acceptance tests, we know that all the software is working as it is supposed to, or as we have specified. And I get the telecom industry has been doing this for very long. So when the telecom industry gets new hardware or with software that they put into their system, they have acceptance test specifications they send to the vendors and say, before you come with any of our equipment, you need to pass all these tests. There's a long list of tests. And when they come, typically they will bring them into the lab of the telecom operator, and they would jointly run all the tests to make sure that they pass all the tests. And after that, if the test suite is good and complete, then we know that the system works as it's supposed to. This can also work for legacy code, meaning that we don't have to go into the actual classes and objects to test. We just test the way the application works. In our case, if you look at the Codeception acceptance test, what does it do? It interacts with the web browser. It says, okay, I own this page, I click this link, I see this, I don't see this. So we don't need to know anything about how it was implemented. We just care about the interface, which then is also a problem, because it's much harder to detect the problem. If you find the problem, it's not easy to know what broke. You have to go into all the details of your code to find what actually broke this. There's no need for breaking encapsulation, meaning that we don't need to know anything what's inside any of the classes. We don't need to have access directly to any of the methods of the class. And typically written by non-developers. Sometimes this is written by the customer, or at least very close connection with the customer. In the telco case, that's the telecom industry case I mentioned, it is the case. It's the telecom, the customer, who specifies the test. So these are the tests that you need to pass. And then that's the expected behavior, and we know that the system behaves that way. Test strategy. I don't know if Tom talked about it, but in my mind, a good test strategy is an agile strategy, which means we test early and we test often. So test early, what does that mean? Well, in the extreme case, we can go for a test-driven development. And what does a test-driven development mean?
Write the test and then try to make code that passes the test.
Yes, you start by writing the test. Because the test is specification of what it is supposed to be, either at the class level or at the system level. You write the test, and then you write the code. And when the code passes the test, you're happy. Because then you know it works the way it should be. That's test-driven. Do we all work that way? No. We rarely do. Very rarely do we do that. But it is a good thing to do it. It's a good thing to at least test as early as possible. So maybe you test as you develop the code. So you develop something, you start thinking, oh, I need to consider this. And then you write it, and then you write the test at the same time, because you will, as programmers, you will test what you have been writing. So if you put your test in the test file, rather than just test by adding print statements and breakpoints and everything, so if you test by writing tests, then the benefit is that, number one, you get to test what you just implemented. Number two, it's in the test suite, so it can be used later again. Whatever prints you put in, you need to remove them in the production code. And when you find a problem, you need to reinsert the print statements to see where you are. You follow me? So make it, if you don't start with a test, at least do it in parallel to your development, so that when you test what you implemented, you test it through the test rather than adding lots of prints and methods to see what's happening. What does regression testing mean? Did Tom talk about it? Hmm. So what does it mean? Regression. Yes, when you change something, it should work. Because regression means it regresses, it deteriorates. What worked at some point stops working. So you had this great system that worked, you make a small change, and all of a sudden, less work. And they make another change, and less work, and less work, and less work. You don't want that to happen. Because of that, you create a test suite that tests everything, and when you change something, you rerun the tests to make sure that nothing else broke than what you fixed. And if you find a new problem, you create a new test, so next time when you fix something, even that problem is being tested for. So we add to the test suite as we learn more about problems, and every time we build the code, we make sure that all the tests are run to make sure that our small change doesn't break anything that's already there. With this, can we get away with the manual testing? What do you think?
Not if our tests are written. Not if we have written our tests wrong.
Exactly. The tests might be wrong as well, and the test might be incomplete. So what we have been testing is what we thought about. But manual testing, especially if you have a test department, there are some studies on, are testers thinking the same way as programmers? What do you think? Would testers and programmers think the same way? No, very differently. So testers are constantly thinking, how can I break this? While programmers are thinking, oh, you need to have all this functionality, and it needs to be working, and it's thinking from what it should be, while the testers think about what it should not be. So having a test group, having some testers that are skilled in testing will still be beneficial. But these are expensive people to hire, because they are very trained and skilled, so you would like to use them where they are needed. So the automated testing can take care of all the simple things that you should have detected, and then the test department can work on the harder ones, and when they find something that breaks, you make sure that that case is covered in your test suite. So next time, you don't need the test department to find that problem again. So you learn. And as we were saying, at least unit tests and acceptance tests, and if you use a framework in Codeception, you would also do functional tests to make sure that the interaction between the framework and your code is working. So if you go up here, so unit testing, it's small, easy to find the problems, quick to run. Acceptance testing, harder to run, there's much more involved, harder to track the problem. And then the functional testing will be in between. It has a little bit of both. We could test our code with the framework without taking the full cost of running an acceptance test. So that makes sense to have a special test suite for that. What is test coverage? Well, if you go back to this diagram, test coverage means, have we covered all the cases. So in your code, you will have ifs and switches. You have branches. And one of the measures of good code is that you have tested all the branches. So if you have a branch, 8 hours or less, we are here. 12 hours or less, we are here. 16 hours or less, we are here. We want to make sure that we are into all these test branches. So we test all these cases. So there are a number of tools that will, for a test, will say how big fraction of your code has been tested, meaning how much of it was actually run during your test. So code coverage is a measure for how much of your code was actually visited through the test. Because you have some ifs, and some of these ifs may not have been activated during the testing. And if they weren't, there is a piece of code that you haven't tested. Can we get 100%? Well, I mean, it's going to be terribly expensive. So it's not worth it, probably, because there are usually quite a lot of chunks of code that are trivial. There's no logic, there is no reason for believing that there will be errors there. Errors tend to come up where there is a complex logic. So 100% is not practical, at least. And so what we should strive for is a good coverage, especially in the complex and critical parts of the code, while in the more trivial parts, we don't need to worry so much. Because if it's just shuffling data around, then there's nothing to worry about. So from that point of view, the tests that we've been writing in assignment one is probably a bit overkill. Probably, because some of these functions just store data in the database and get back from the database, and you don't necessarily have to worry so much about it. If you have a big piece of code, you just assume that that's taken care of, so you don't have to worry about it. But in our case, this is our focus, to make sure that we operate on the database in the right way. So for us, it's important. But as you get skilled, you will say, code that just shuffles data back into the database, you may not worry about much testing there, because you know it's stored, and if it's stored, you know you can get it back. But for us, it's important. For us, it is a critical part, but eventually it may be a more trivial part. Before we take a break, just I'm not pushing you to think in test-driven development. I wouldn't say that is what you should do, but I think you should run in a test-integrated development way, as I was saying, as I would consider it. So rather than the traditional waterfall, so you design module ABC, you implement ABC, and then you test. So rather have this big cycle, this kind of waterfall, you design something, and you implement, and you test, you will work module A and design something, implement some of it, test, and then iteratively, and you do the same for B and for C, possibly also in parallel. So rather than having this large view on you design, you implement, you test, you work, you design something, you add a bit of functionality, and then you test it, and you go back in that cycle. Oh, there was one more. Okay. Just one more before a break. Behavior-driven development. What is this? It is about making specifications of use cases and of tests in a kind of a natural language. So this is an example from Codeception. So Codeception has support for this. So if you would like to write the tests, you can write scenarios. Scenarios would be cases that you want to test. And you write it in this kind of language. So you would actually write this. Given I have product with 600 price in my cart, I have this record in the database, I am on this page, I click order. And I have product. This is a test specification. This is quite similar to the manual testing you did, but it's written in a language. Gherkin, that is a behavior-driven testing language. That makes this easy to compile this into the tests. You can see, those of you who have looked at the acceptance test, you can see kind of the similarity. I am on page, I click. So this can easily be compiled into and converted into the actual code. So writing acceptance tests this way, it is foreseeable that an end user can write this without having to know PHP or anything. Because this is language independent. If you know Gherkin, you can write this, and if you have a testing environment that can parse Gherkin and make the tests for you, that's what you do. You write it this way. This looks like natural language. It isn't. I mean, it's a very restricted natural language, but it's very close to what we see in our acceptance tests, and that's why they have their own compilers that will take this and compile it into the acceptance test that we have, and then the Codeception will run this. Okay, let's take a break there. 15 minutes. Yes. So let's... So let's get into the some more of the details. So what we did so far is probably just repetition from what Tom was talking about to a large degree. But now let's go into the more the details of the framework that we've chosen, which is Codeception. I look at unit testing and acceptance testing from that point of view. And I'll use some of the code that you already have there. So it's not, I'm not going to give you any code that you haven't seen before if you looked at the assignment code, but tomorrow we'll write some new tests and go through the whole process. But today it's just going to be the examples that you haven't seen, just to help you to explain it. So, unit tests. In Codeception, the way to write a unit test is, of course, then let's bring us all up to the same state. So if you look at the, is this readable? Yeah. If you look at the source code directory, we run the composer, and the composer will create a vendor directory. And in the vendor directory, we have Codeception, and under bin, that's where we have the file that we can run to run Codeception. And when we bootstrap Codeception, and we ask you to create the various files, then the test directory will be coming up. In the test directory, we have three YAML files. These are basically just parameter files for the test suite. So when Codeception starts, it reads this and see what are the modules I'm supposed to use. And if I'm going to do some database testing, it needs to include that DSN here. The database module. This says that the database module needs to be loaded. This is the source, and this is the user, the password, and some parameters here that decide on how much or how the database is going to clean up. I'll talk about that in a while. So why, on the acceptance tester, why bring in the database module? Because it means that we can also have Codeception check directly on the database. We don't do that, so we don't necessarily need it in the acceptance test YAML file, but in the unit YAML file, we do need it. And then under the unit, that's where the various unit test files will be. In this case, we have just one class to test, which is the DB model, and it's related to book collections. So that's why we had just one test there. So the test file, and then in there, we need the test to be extending the unit test Codeception class. So if we go here and look at the book collection test, so it has the Codeception unit test that it includes. Tests are the public methods that start with test something. If you want to have helper functions in your test class, you could either make them protected, which means that test is not going to take them up, or you have some name that doesn't say test in the beginning, because the naming convention here the Codeception is using is that all tests are public functions starting with test. And it will try to run all of this. Then we have the assertion functions. And as I said, why do we have assertion functions? Well, because we have an initial state, we call an operation, and then assertions are being used to test that the result state of the object is as expected. So we assert certain values to be there. And if that's not the case, then Codeception will complain and say, hey, there is a broken test here. Broken test doesn't mean that the code is broken. May mean that the test itself was wrong. And we may need to fix the test, which is kind of extra challenge or something that we need to pay for extra, is that once we get into testing, we also introduce bugs in our tests. that also needs to be fixed, which is kind of extra work. That's why we try to favor small tests, so small that there aren't big chances of making bugs in the tests, so incomplete. As I said, tests, test-driven, we write the test first, or we write them during development, so we add some functionality, we test it, we add functionality, we test it, or after it's been implemented. I don't recommend that one, because then we do quite a lot of hand testing here, that's wasted work, and then we have to redo the test work here, so it's more worked for us. So, how would this look like? Now, we call it unit test, but usually a unit test will be just a test of one class, but in our case, we use the PDO. So it's getting more to be kind of a module test, because you're also testing the database part, not just the class itself. But since when we deal with databases, you will have to have the database part of it. So that's why we still call it a unit test, and that's why Codeception has the unit test tools for dealing with database values as well. Three parts. We need to set up the initial state. In this case, the initial state is we define some test values. We have an example book that has a title, an author, and a description. And we create a new book based on these values. Now, what do we want to test? That is the operation add book. So in the model, we call add book. What do we expect after this? Because that's what the test is. So we have a database. We add a book. What do we expect after that? We expect that book data to be in the database. So that's what we test. So first of all, we need to make sure that the book that was inserted got an ID. You remember with the database assigning the ID, because it's an auto-increment. So when we store it in the database, it will get an ID in the database, but our memory object does not have it unless we remember to set it in the book object. So the first test is to make sure that that was done. So the book object actually has an ID. And we want to see four rows in the book table, because we know there were only three when we started the test. The test database has three rows. Now we expect to see four rows. And then we want to see that this actual row was inserted. And a way to do that is to get a tester object. So the tester is a Codeception object that we could use to run the acceptance tests and use to run operations towards the database. So in this case, the tester goes into the database and see in the table book, do we have a row where we have ID for title, test values, author, test values, description, test values. To see that this row is in the database. I said that there were some errors that I hadn't yet announced, and the error is in these asserts, assert equals, because this should be the order. It doesn't matter for the comparison for the assertion, because the comparison will tell you that this was a mismatch. But what it will say is that this is what was expected, and this is what the actual value is. And in the example code, they are flipped. So the book ID would be first, and then number four, the second, which means that the assertion will fail when it's supposed to fail, will work, will go through when it's supposed to, but if it fails, it will give you the wrong answer. It will say, I was expecting this number, and I got four. So the error message you get is incorrect. So I'm not sure if I'm going to check in everything and you check it out again. The quickest thing for you to do is to go through the test files and change the order of the assert functions so that they are flipped around the way they should be. I'll put up a note on that when I get to it. And just for, not to excuse myself, but just for warning you, the reason why this ended up incorrectly is that I copied some code examples from Codeception. And when you find code on the internet, don't just copy it. Just go through it and see if it's correct. I didn't do that, so shame on me. Slap on the hands. Just be careful. Even though in this case it was the Codeception's own documentation, doesn't mean that examples you find, you should just take them. So my fault. Yeah. We have the initial state. We call the operation, and then we test the resulting state. We have certain expectations, and we just see that these expectations are being met. Assertions go to the Codeception documentation. You find there are operations for seeing whether an object contains something. You have a number of something, whether a value is equal to something, greater than, less than. If you find null, if you find false, if it returns true, if it's... I don't know, how many have been writing regular expressions? You should all learn regular expressions. That's so good tool. Go ahead and learn it, and here you can assert based on regular expression. So if you have complex string values, just go ahead and use regular expressions. And there are some other string functions, like you can say a string will start with, but you can also express that in regular expression. So if you can a regular expression, that's faster to do that than using finding which are the other string functions you have. We're not going to go through all of them. You have them on Codeception. So if you go, just to show you where it is. So if you have Codeception in the documentation, we are on asserts. This is the asserts module, and if you remember the YAML file, it says asserts are included. So this assert module is included. So here are all the asserts with examples. And again, be careful about the examples. They may not be correct. If you look at here, the order of parameters here is correct. The what's shown in the example may not be correct. There was a change request file from this course to Codeception, so maybe it's fixed in not too long. If there are exceptions, then what we need to do is to say that we expect an exception. And this is, in C++, you've probably not seen the passing functions like this. So what we do say is that we expect this class, and this is the function we want to call. And when this function is called, so we just put in the function here, say what function it is, it's calling this function, and it should return an exception. Just copy that syntax. Or if you really like to try to understand it, this is quite useful to be able to pass anonymous functions as parameters to other functions. But it's a bit more heavy programming that you don't have to for to understand what's going on here. What I was thinking is, let's go back here, just to explain what a little bit of interaction between the various parts here. So, because Codeception is driving this, so if you look at what's happening here, so when we start Codeception, where we say run unit, what's going to happen is that Codeception is first going to the database. Oops, sorry, it should be this one. The first thing is that Codeception goes to the database to clean up what was there before and set up a new database that has these three books that we know. And then Codeception will run the test. The test will go to the database model. The database model will go to PDO. And then PDO will go to the database. And then results will come back. And here, then the object is here in the book collection test. We have the object, and then we can, in the test, call assert or expect exception. We can call the test framework for all our testing functions. asserts and exceptions and see in database and whatever. You follow me? And this happens for every test. Every test, Codeception would start by cleaning up the database, will then run the next test. That will go to the model, that will go to PDO, that will go to database, that will return data, that will change the state of this object, the DB model object, in the collection test file, and then or class, and then we can just run the test to see that the state is what we expect it to be. Something has disappeared from the database, something has changed in the database, something has been added to the database. We do it all here by calling Codeception. Is this clarifying, kind of understanding how this all works? So if you look at the unit tests, so here, unit tests, this is the database setup. And when we create the model, we use this database. So this needs then, of course, to match what Codeception is having in its parameter in the YAML file. And then for the test, before this is a public function, starting with tests. This is a test. So before this is run, then the Codeception is going to the database, cleaning up the database, creating a new book table. Then it will go through getting all the results and make sure that we have three books and the ID of the one is 1, 2, 3. And I test the title, I test the author, and I test the description. Why did I design it this way? We talked about partitioning, equivalence partitioning. And what am I testing here? Am I testing that there are three in the book list? I'm testing that the IDs are 1, 2, and 3. And I test that they all have values for title, author and description, but I don't test each one of them. I test just one for each. I just want to know that they are all different from the IDs. I just want to make sure that I can get values for author, description, and title. You see the point? I could have for book one also tested the author and description. For book two, also tested for title and description. Book three for ID and author in addition to description. I didn't do that. I just assumed that if it worked for one, it worked for the others. But I wanted to make sure that the books, I could probably also have skipped this one here, the ID, because if it worked for two books, it's very unlikely that it would fail for the third book. If there was something in the model that made it just pick the same object, or it found three objects, but it created the same one three times, then I would detect this way by testing the IDs. And now I test that I do see a title, I do see an author, I do see a description, and assume that since I see it for one object, I will see it for all objects. You follow me? So that's the kind of thinking here. We try to make tests that have a good coverage, but not necessarily test all combinations of activities. Which, by the way, for tomorrow's design, which I detected now that this is the book list is not a good... The example database is not good, since if I order based on titles, weren't I? Yeah, the order of titles was the same as the order of IDs, so it was not perfect from that point of view. But so that's something that we learn gradually. What are good test cases? Are there any questions to unit testing using Codeception? I do have a couple of you reporting that things that are deleted from the database doesn't appear in the search. I need to look at that. I don't know what the issue could be, but I will be looking at it and see, because if that is breaking, then we have a problem. But except for known problems, do you have any other questions or issues related to the unit testing? There is more to know about it. So if you go to Codeception manual, you will find that there are something called mock objects. We're not talking about mock objects here. If you want to go more into testing, then that's the way to get around complexities when you have some class using other classes. But we don't have to worry about it, because this is not a core testing class. It's about database application testing. So we just established the basics. But there's more. No other questions on unit testing? Hopefully now you're able to gradually write your own test, and hopefully they pass when they're supposed to. Then, acceptance testing. When in Codeception and in web applications. Acceptance testing, what is that? What does it mean? Well, it means that we open the page, we look at what the HTML page contains, and we may click, we may fill in a form, we may interact with the page. What does that mean? Well, that's exactly what the browser does. So when I, as a user, click on something, then the browser will parse the HTML and say, okay, now I need to send this GET or I need to send this POST based on my click. So most web testing frameworks will have either a browser built in. They are emulating a browser, so they're using the browser library. So most browsers are developed on the same code base, a library of functions that browsers can use. And that code base is then implemented inside the testing framework. So it's a browser emulator. And this is pretty efficient because that browser doesn't have to deal with anything with the user interface. Because there is no user, it's just a program. And so it doesn't have to deal with user interface, only the functionality based on what the user will do. And it will have access to the HTML results. So it's pretty efficient, but these browsers, they generally don't have support for JavaScript, drag and drop, advanced user interface interaction. So if we would like to test an application that is very rich, we may need to actually interact with a real browser. So in Codeception as well, we can use a server. We can set up a server that will interact. Selenium is the usual one that can interact with a real browser. So when we run the test, whatever operation we do on the page is being sent through the server to the real browser. And the real browser does go and get the results and will inform back to the Codeception what the result was. So we interact with the real browser through some libraries and interconnecting some pieces. But that means that this is going to be a more complex and also a slower solution, because you need to bring up the browser, you have a server, you communicate to the browser via the server, and the browser has a lot of other stuff it does, so it's more complex and it's a bit slower. And then we have the fact that we are interacting with another program. But if you have very complex interactions, JavaScript, then we may need to do it this way. Where do we set all of this? So if you go to the book collection, the acceptance suite YAML file, we see here the PHP browser module. The PHP browser module is our emulator. If we wanted to use Chrome, we can set up the Selenium and the Chrome connector here, and then the test would run on Chrome. So here in the YAML file, we tell Codeception how the acceptance tests are going to be run. In our case, we use the PHP browser by going to this URL. This is where our application is running. You get the picture? So let's not do that right away. Let's see. We can do it. So how does it work? So we have our test. It will go to Codeception, and we are on page. Oops. Okay. What would Codeception do there? What's happening then When I'm on the page. What will, in our case, if we open index.html, what happens on the browser? We have an HTTP GET. Controller, when it gets it's not talking to the view, it's talking to the model. What's it going to do? If you look at the code, the controller, it calls getBookList. Wasn't it? What does DB model do? First, it connects to the database. We need to create a PDO object that connects to the database. What's the next thing? In your code, those of you who have started making a DB model, when it gets, when it's, you get a get book list call, what's DB model going to do? This is for
a query.
This is typical for all database operations. What do we do? Well, one, we connect, we run a query, we get the results. We may bind parameters, but in our case, there is no parameters because we're going to get everything. So there's no parameters to bind. So the second one is connect, which is then the query. And after query, oops. I can could have been better. What do? We fetch the result, fetch one row. So that means that we can take this one over here. And we get one row. But there are more rows, so we're going to keep on doing this, fetching rows, and so as long as there are more rows, we're going to do that. And then we have all the then we have our book list. A book list coming back to the controller. Question?
Instead of fetching each row individually, couldn't we just use fetch all?
Couldn't you use fetch all? Yes, you can. I think I mentioned it very briefly. Fetch all would be nice if your database isn't too big. But if you have a huge database, fetch all would dump everything. So if you just need to show the 21st or the from 100 to 120, if you want to page it, fetch all would dump everything to your database. And the number one performance parameter or number one performance bottleneck in a database is data transport. There's no much computation. It's about copying data from the disk to the file system buffer, to the database buffer, to the interface to the or to the client server buffer on the server side, to the client buffer side, server on the client side, to the memory of your code. So it's going to be copied many times. So we want to make sure that as little as possible is copied through individually getting the ones we know we are interested in. We reduce the data flow. So that's why we fetch them individually. But yes, for convenience, and yes, in small databases, fetch all is nice. It's convenient, but remember, we're going to come back to this a couple of times in this course. Convenience for the programmer versus convenience for the software. Let the software be efficient. Don't save yourself two minutes and make the software suffer from it. So fetch all, but yes, you could. It would do the same thing. So you get your book list. If you looked at the code, what does the controller do? Model view controller? Well, it will create a view. And then you have, let's see here, the controller gets the book list page. Oops. And then the book list page is returned to the collection. Sorry, it goes to here, to Codeception. And then the page is loaded. Then I can start to interact. So then I can call I see something. Oops. And I see more, and I click, and whatever. You see the flow? So this is the kind of sequence diagram I would like you to draw, because that tells me that you have understood how a test is talking to the Codeception, which is actually in this case just a browser. It's not the end user talking to the browser. It's our test code. The browser will then, the controller, my get disappeared. Okay, I moved it. Sorry, there should be a get here. HTTP get. Usually write it in capital. This is how Codeception, our program works with Codeception. Codeception works with HTTP, and HTTP works with the controller. The controller works with the database model. Database model interacts with the PDO, and then it's all tied up. So it's a bit more complex than the we already saw the model view controller sequence from the controller, the user here, not the Codeception, but the user, and going back. And now it's basically setting up the initial state, which is we are on a certain page, and then the asserts. These are the three parts: setting up the initial stage, this is invoking the function, and here is asserting the results that we get back. Is this too much detail, or is it okay to go through the flow and see it gradually built up? So this is the final one. It's in your slides, so you can see it there. Now, I think I talked about CSS querying at the very end on a Friday, so we didn't come to actually show how we could use the tools, because what we want to do now is to say, okay, I see different things, and the easiest is to say just I see and the content of what we see, but very often we would also want to see that the structure is right, and the structure is through CSS. And here, if you see here, what does this mean? Well, that means that on this page there is a row in a table, and the row has the ID book 1. That row has a child, the first TD child of that row, first child, has an anchor. You follow me? So, and this is kind of overwhelming, all of this, but luckily we have our tools to play with. So if we go here, and we bring up the developer. Do you remember how to bring up the developer tools? So if you go here, then there are some more tools and developer tools. So these are the ones I have here. Let's see. So if we go to console, in the console, I can write functions, JavaScript functions. There is one nice JavaScript function, which is $. It just gives us an interface for querying for CSS. So if I like to see, is there a tr here? Then I can open and I can see there are four rows. This is row number one, this is row number two, this is row number three, this is row number four. You see that? And I can say, okay, is there a row that has ID book one? Yeah, there is one. So if I go there, I can see this is the row. Does that row have a TD child? Yes, it has three of them, or four. The first one being ID, second being Jungle Book. So I have all. Does it have, which is the first child TD? Well, there's one out of those. This is the first child. Okay, now, does it have an anchor to it? Yes, it does. You follow me? So I can go through the hierarchy, because if I look at the source code here, so you need to know a little bit about HTML. So if you look at the source code here, we say this is the book, it has, there is a row, it has, this is the first TD. In the first TD, there is an anchor. So this is what I'm testing for. A question? Yes, the anchor is the actual link. So I wanted to make sure that there's a link here that I can click. That's what the test is all about. Is there a link here that I can click? And yes, there is. Now, if I tried here on the, not the first child, but the nth child, and say number three. So this will be then be the four, because number three has an anchor as well. But four doesn't seem to have an anchor. Description doesn't have an anchor. So if I try to test, no, it's empty. There is no anchor. So that then it's empty. I don't see an anchor on the fourth TD. You follow me? So use these tools when you write the test. So what do I see? Do I see a fourth row here? Do I see an element there? Do I see an anchor here? And use CSS to identify, to locate the ones that you're interested in, to see not that there is a number one somewhere on the place, but the number one is actually the first row in this table, on the first column in this table, and it has a link to it that they can click. So we know that we are clicking on the right thing. So what I'm testing for here is that I see that link. So in this case, what do I see? I see the Jungle Book here as the nth child, which then is the title of the book. I see the author and I see written by. So I can go and test. What do I see on the page? On a certain spot, not just on the page, but on a certain spot. That's why I use CSS here. Play with it, and you get to be familiar gradually. How do we follow a link? Pretty straightforward. The I object is the tester. So in the Codeception, they talk about actors, and actors are the testers. So this is the I object is a tester that, in this case, the tester is on the page, and the tester see a link. There is a link with the text 1, and it's pointing to index.php id equals 1. Now I would like to click that link. Click 1. The 1 is the text here on that link, and I can see it, so that's why I go and click it. And then that page will be loaded, and then I look at the results. How do we submit forms? You are on the page, and on the page you can ask the tester or I to submit the form. And this is the CSS that will find the form, and the form has an ID, so we can just use the CSS for that ID. And then we have already checked that form is there on another test. And then we say, okay, we want for title, we want this value. For author, we want this value. And for description, we want this value, the values that we set up here. And then this form is being submitted, and the result comes back to Codeception, and we can then assert. We can assert that it was inserted, it is in the list and everything. Any questions about the acceptance testing? As I said, in the YAML file, I include a database module, but right now we are not using it for much other than for cleaning the database between all the tests. So what Codeception will do with the database module, it will go to your database and clean it between each of the acceptance tests. That's why you need to make sure that you run on that database. So you run on the correct database, as we saw in the YAML file. So, and that DB object is being called with the same parameter, as you saw in the before statement. So the before statement or function and the YAML file points to the same database. Okay, so is it worth the effort to learn Codeception, to spend all the time writing all this code, to debug test code, and bring all that into the picture? I mean, also maintain it. So when you get a bug report, you need to fix the bug and you change the test. And maybe you introduce a problem in the test, so something else breaks. But it wasn't the other program's fault, it was the test code. So you need to maintain the test as well. So is it worth the effort? The industry believes so. Because, as Tom was explaining, the development time and the development resources are small compared to the maintenance. So most of the resources on our software will be on maintaining it. And if you don't have a test suite, even more time and resources will go there. With the test suite, we know that if there's something wrong, the test will find most of them. If it didn't find it, we get the bug report, we find the problem, we write a new test, meaning that next time we ship code, we have tested for that problem as well. So the quality of the code improves for every step. There is overhead, yes, but there are big savings when it comes to maintenance costs. And you, anyway, will spend a lot of time on testing what you write. You probably use prints and you use the debugger, especially in C++, to traverse through and see that everything is okay. Why not use that time writing a good test instead? Because then you can use it as you develop, and it's also part of the test suite that you will ship later on, so that for maintenance, all those problems that you tested for, they will be continuously tested. So when something's changed in your code, it won't break this part. It won't regress. So remember your test strategy. Find a good balance between too many tests and too few tests. There. The reading material is all on Codeception. It's linked to here, and it's linked to in Blackboard, and you find it in Codeception. Thank you. So tomorrow we go through this little bit about database testing, and then we go through a case.